Always enjoy it when I get a chance to speak with my friend Dr. John Jackson, friend of decades, the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. Hi, John. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Tom. I'm glad to be with you.
I got a ton of stuff, so if I'm going to start, I'm going to start just right out of the box with you, okay?
Okay.
You know, you and I have trusted polls, seen polls, watched polls, created polls for decades, and now when it comes to presidential polls in 2016, I can't help but every time I see a poll think there ought to be a disclaimer at the end of it, you know, because I'm wondering if anybody really knows anymore.
Well, it is difficult to do polling these days, and it's gotten increasingly harder. For example, the whole issue of cell phones and all of that, and now they're using computers, and technology's gotten complicated. So, yeah, there's a right to be skeptical. On the other hand, that's why we have a margin of error. Pollsters never claim the precision that people think they're claiming. It's usually plus or minus 3.5 in a good sample, for example. So keep in mind, they don't actually claim quite as much accuracy as is popularly believed. But nevertheless, 2016 made people skeptical. On the other hand, pollsters have adjusted what they're doing since 2016, so we'll have to see.
And I think it's interesting when you say, look, we got the logistics of creating polls and how you get a hold of people and things. And it's interesting because at the same time, we run a sound bit from in ZK about COVID-19 and where people don't want to talk to whoever's on the other end of the phone. They don't want to tell them stuff. They don't want to tell them about their health condition. They don't want to give them that information. And I think there's a reservation there. People have become, well, I heard one broadcaster refer to it as a shy voter, somebody who doesn't want to tell you that information.
The refusal rate has gone up, and pollsters have tried to adjust to that. They have to now make more phone calls than they used to get their quota, their number.
You know, when it comes to it, COVID, I think, adds its own complexities. And it's interesting, even I've had a couple of people saying, look, can you take the COVID filter off and see things that aren't through that filter? And that is a very big and very, very confusing filter, I think, when people see the world through that. And it's very clearly in the rhetoric on the campaign trail has an influence when it comes to what's topical. I mean, the fact is there are other policy decisions. There are things going on that don't have anything to do with COVID, which kind of get pushed to the back seat, if not the trunk.
Well, that's true. But I think COVID, for example, is to a large extent driving this massive early turnout. We've seen unprecedented levels of turnout. We've already voted more early votes than the total last time. So I think it's just there, and it's a part of what's going on in these stories that we see constantly about how big the early turnout is.
Well, and John, here's this. The U.S. Elections Project, University of Florida, that is 29 electoral votes, which is why they're there now, is saying that 80 million Americans have now cast those early votes. And I think that's very interesting because you and I are both big fans of participation. And it's amazing that it took a pandemic to create that type of involvement. But I guess you could look at it that way.
Yeah, I think we'll probably break records this time. I think turnout, if I remember correctly, was 60.5%. Last time, we're likely to go well above that this time.
And 60% is high.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, as a lifelong Illinois resident, don't you kind of resent the fact that we don't get much attention when it comes to presidential elections? It bothers me that we don't see the candidate come here.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be good. On the other hand, about 40 states don't. Only about 10 states get any personal attention because they are the states that are competitive, the toss-up states, and candidates are crisscrossing, meeting each other in Tampa yesterday, for example.
Yeah, well, David Yepsen's lonely out in the cornfield in Iowa.
yeah, not a lot of attention there.
All right, so when I try to look at what I think is going to be big on the ballot in Illinois, the presidential race, sure, no doubt about it. But we've got some other interesting races. Durbin and Curran, Mark Curran and Dick Durbin. That's an interesting race. I have no sense of it other than the fact that, well, you've got the incumbency of Dick Durbin that's going decades. I don't know what it takes to get an incumbent out. I don't know what the current people in campaign plan was, besides get out there and do some walking and talking. What are your thoughts on this race, John?
Well, I think you can judge by the television. That is, there are pretty steady Dick Durbin ads, and I haven't seen a single one for Curran.
Yeah.
That shows that Curran doesn't have the money. And your question about incumbency is absolutely true. They're very hard to dislodge. And the same thing's happening in Kentucky, although that's a closer race there. But nevertheless, McConnell seems to be leading there. So, yeah, unless either senator had done something really egregious, they're not likely to be dislodged. And that seems to be the case in both of those races.
It's interesting, John, the minute you said that, I had a flash. And I'm watching TV and I'm seeing commercials out of Kentucky. And Mitch's opponent says, he's been there too long. Well, if I'm on the Durbin campaign across the river, I'm saying, shut up. know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's saying it's too long and the Republicans should go. Well, how long is too long? We don't know the answer to that, but just a random thought. Now, there's another. Have you got a thought on that too, John?
No, other than I think Durbin's been there one less than McConnell, if I remember correctly. But yes, I see your point.
So, and the other one, of course, is a congressional race, and one of those is John Shimkus. We talked about the power of incumbency, and it's real. But when it comes to John Shimkus' seat, we've got two unknowns. We have literally two unknowns running for that congressional seat.
Yeah, and that, of course, then revolves back to what is the strength of the party at the base. That used to be a competitive seat. You may remember Shimkus had to take on David Phelps, who was Glenn Pichard's successor in that seat, and they got put together in the 2000 redistricting, and Shimkus won that closely over Phelps, and it has become increasingly Republican, so I would bet on Miller in that race.
Yeah, you and I have been around long enough to know that that whole section of Southern Illinois, Gallatin County, Democrat, Democrat, hardcore Democrat.
Yeah.
And that's
the only county that Jim Edgar didn't win, which he never forgot and never forget.
And you know what? I think Jim Thompson, too.
Yeah,
I'm trying
that's
to think.
Probably
was it,
true.
Yeah, I think it was. It was Gallatin because I was in the room when they were talking about it. And the subject came up of a bridge. And David Phelps was in the room and wanted some money for a bridge for the school buses to go over, and they didn't have rails on them. And Jim says, that's the county I lost next.
Yeah, he would remember that.
Yeah. All right, so Ray Lindsey, Mike Boss, there's another one, the incumbency, but relatively new, an area that was Democrat for many, many years. I've spoke with the people of the Ray Lindsey campaign. They say it's time for it to become Democrat again. Ray Lindsey and Mike Bost. What's the story there, John?
Well, it is typical of what's happened in Southern Illinois. We lag the South, but we've joined the South in terms of traditional Democratic base, the Solid South, as it was called, for 75 years. Over about 20 years, transition to the Solid Republican South now, in presidential terms at least. And we are a lagging indicator, but that's basically what's happened in Southern Illinois in the last decade or so, outside Jackson County and Alexander County.
Fair tax. Now, that's one. Now,
that's a big one.
That is, and you know what? I think that's going to be, I think it'll drive people to the polls. And we're already talking about record, but I'm trying to think of just, you know, south of 64, right? Our home. And I tell you, all I can tell you is my messaging here at News Radio WJPF through our text services and email and social media is no, no, no. And I think what they're saying, they're not saying no to fair tax. They're saying no to taxes, period. I mean, that's the way I'm feeling it. Have you seen any information on this, that one way or another?
Well, taxes are always unpopular. It's not recent by any stretch. We've been doing polling since 2008, and we do two things. Number one, ask where would we get new revenue if we wanted to balance the budget, and the least popular source is any new revenue coming from new taxes. So that's number one. Number two, we ask them a long list of services. Do you want this, 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 and this cut in order to balance the Illinois budget? And the answer is no to all of those, right, because they're services we depend on. So the question is, the supporters of the graduated income tax say that they are trying to address that $3.5 billion deficit. And if not this, then what? And that is the argument they're making. And others are counter that with, we hate taxes and our taxes are going to go up if this passes.
Yeah.
They'd say, the critics, there's of their fair tax.
The psychology of this, though, is complicated by the fact that we have the richest elected official in America as governor of Illinois saying we should raise taxes on the richest. There are 17 billionaires.
Right.
There's a psychological component to that, and that's not even and that's not counting the whole toilet issue. Somebody who says taxes are so high they take toilets out of their home to cut down on taxes, that there's a theater of the mind aspect to this when it comes to, okay, you say you want to raise taxes, but you know, you actually paid back money because you didn't pay the right taxes because of these activities, and $56 million plus out of his own pocket to be able to support the measure. And I think that it convolutes the issue at the least.
Well, I think that's a good point, but keep in mind that he's been totally countered with almost exactly the same amount, $50 million from Ken Griffith, who is the richest man in Illinois. He's even richer than the governor. So you're seeing one ad for one side and one ad for the other, ironically paid for by two multi-billionaires, one of whom says he thinks he ought to pay more taxes and that the other guy ought to pay more taxes too, and the other guy trying to stop that. So I think that's an interesting phenomenon of all of those ads may just counterbalance one another and not really have a huge impact, although we'll see if it gets down to minus 60. It's got to be at 60 or above in order to pass.
Right.
We were at 66% approved when this thing started, and we'll see if that approval for the graduated income tax gets taken down. And if so, it'll be because of television and those ads.
Yeah, a whole heap of money. We're a big, huge pile of money.
Yeah.
Speaking of huge piles of money, it's almost like watching the Illinois Supreme Court race being run this year.
Yeah.
It reminds me, I've got to tell you, it reminds me exactly of Mag Carmire. Almost like it's a do-over.
Exactly. Exactly the parallel. And that one came down to $9 million being spent, which at that time was a national record for a Supreme Court race anywhere. It's gotten to be commonplace now that people from outside and all over are spending big money for these Supreme Court races. And it's Mag Carmire all over again, with the exception, I would add, that as we were talking about earlier, the district has become more Republican since 2004, which I believe was Mag Carmire.
All right. Now, and if you listen to that, the region... This is important because when it comes to Supreme Court, not everybody in the state of Illinois is voting on this.
Yeah, right. It's whatever, 30 counties, I believe it is.
Right, for that district, the Southern District.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's important. All right, I've been waiting a long time to ask you this next question, John.
I hope I know the answer in that case.
Well, there's a reason why I don't. Dr. John Jackson, Paul Simon, Public Policy Institute. Never do I remember in recent history seeing so many unchallenged incumbents in Southern Illinois win towards Severn, right? Looking at the race for Senate, for all intents and purposes, Terry Bryant's the senator.
Oh, yeah, and the same with Paul Jacobs.
Right. So why? Why didn't the Democrats put up challengers against these people in Southern Illinois? Now, we can say because increasingly Republican, but it's never stopped them in any place that was Republican before. There was always somebody on the court playing. They were ready to go. Why not this year?
I think it is exactly that, though. It's been now that way for so long that it's hard to recruit people. It's a lot of trouble, a lot of expense, and you give up 6 or 8 months of your life if you're going to be serious about one of these challenges. Ray Lindsey, for example, that's a lot of work to take on, in this case, somebody that is effectively the incumbent in the case of Terry Bryant, for example. And the Democrats just couldn't find anybody to do it.
Well, all right. Now, here's the part that bothers me about that, because if we're both right about this, and the Democrats have a supermajority, both houses, every state office, Democrat, if they've decided we don't need Southern Illinois, why would we fight and spend the money? We don't need it. We already have a supermajority. We don't need those people, and we don't need them for anything, and that marginalizes the whole district, the whole region, because we've got control from the rest, and we don't need that. We're not going to challenge it. We're going to go on about a business. We're going to get what we want. Not being included or considered in this respect, I think that maybe you might celebrate not having a, you know, an opponent if you're a Republican, but the ramifications of that, if we're correct, is we don't need you anyway. You're marginalized.
Yeah, I think there's a real problem with that, and it sort of is a vicious cycle. You know, we feel left out, and if we get to be a one-party district, we are effectively left out, unless the Republicans are able, as in the case of both the budget and the infrastructure bill, the gas tax bill in 2019,
right,
if they're able to get to the bargaining table and play a role as they did then, but they are increasingly likely to just say, I'm going to vote my district, and thus I'm not going to give any inch at all. And that's the danger of being polarized. We need to have less polarization and a little more cooperation across the aisles.
Well, you know, I mean, Dr. Jackson, I mean, you could say that the Southern Illinois legislators are relegated to the being gadflies in the Socratic thoughts here, right? That nothing more than a constant daily irritation and nothing more. I mean, I don't want our legislators to be gadflies. I want them to be active and being able to get things done. And I mean, I can see them being relegated to that category.
Well, I think there is a danger to that, and they do find other things that they can get done. For example, Senator Fowler with the Port District, he got on the governor's good side, and the governor has helped him on that Port District down in Cairo, and that's the ideal, that they can continue to play a role, and they've got to look for those opportunities. Otherwise, going to Springfield and yelling about Chicago is not really a strategy for getting things done, because that's just not the way it's going to happen up there, and we might as well learn to accept that and to deal with it.
Dr. John Jackson, now, final question for the day. The ramifications of the presidential election, people are skeptical already. Police are being prepositioned. Rodeo Drive is putting up plywood over their windows. Other towns are preparing for problems, on Wednesday. And what that represents, because this ability to transfer power peacefully was a hallmark of American greatness, and we're seeing that hallmark being threatened and deteriorated, right, to the point where every 4 years we've got to worry about a civil war. I'm worried about how people respond. And when I say that, I don't mean whether it's Trump or Biden, one way or the other. Although if Trump wins, I'm a little more concerned about, you know, looting and things like that. But still, what that means in the, you know, historically has me concerned.
Well, you're right to worry. We've had a peaceful transfer of power from one party to the other since 1800. That was the importance of that election, and we've done that well no matter what. War, depression, anything hasn't stopped us. And I think there has been an unprecedented level of attack on the process this time, and I would have to say it's been led by the president, who has complained endlessly up to and including yesterday about the ballots and how they're being handled. Well, they're being handled at county clerk offices, for example, all across the country and certainly in Illinois, and not any different from the past. And they've already processed 88 million of them. And that shows that the locals are doing what they do. But the president has undermined that endlessly by his rhetoric more than any other person. And he's got the biggest bullhorn anyway. So at any rate, it's very much up in the air as to how well and how peacefully we'll transfer power.
Dr. John Jackson, as always, John, matter of fact, somebody just texted, said Southern Illinois is truly lucky to have a guy like Dr. Jackson, and we love it when he's on the show. We love it when he's on the show with you. So a little note this morning. Doctor, I always appreciate the time, John.
Okay, thank you, Tom.